And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. If you grew up with a favorite record store, bookstore, comic book store, or video store, you know that all these places have closed in large numbers as digital distribution and shopping have surged. We'll take the occasion of National Comic Book Day to reflect on the importance of brick-and-mortar retail to the heart and soul of the things we love. Then we'll move on to a topic every school-age child knows well, science. But in our case, we'll talk about science and scientists and how culture does and doesn't serve our understandings of them. And as always, we'll talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I poke about the fringes of movies and TV and theater and that sort of thing.
Well, I'm going to start by asking Glenn. What I refer to as National Comic Book Day, it's technically Free Comic Book Day.
Exactly,
they
yeah.
call it, which is good marketing. Of
right.
course.
Truth.
Mention the word free in the name. What can you tell us about Free Comic Book Day?
Free Comic Book Day is the industry's annual attempt to reach past people like me, nerds like me, who exist in the shallow shoals, the overfished shoals of comic book fans, and reach out into the deeper waters where fish like you all swim free.
Yeah.
Where the dilettantes roam.
Right, exactly. People who don't particularly care about these characters because they see in that the opportunity to reach great new audiences. So every year they offer up free comics, and if you walk into a comic book store, a participating comic book store, on Saturday, May 4th, they will hand you a bunch of comics, or they will hand you a free comic, or you will get to choose from piles of free comics. Not every store will have every comic. There are over 52 different Free Comic Book Day offerings this year, but a store you go in will have some, and what you want to do is go in there with an open mind. They want you to come.
Yeah.
They want desperately for you to show up at their door. You could go in there and say, what's good? I would recommend for this particular event to go in there and tell them what you like. Because it's their job to recommend, based on the books you like, the films you like, the television shows you like, something that will meet your tastes.
When I went a couple of years ago, I don't think I went last year, but I think maybe I went the year before that. They were very friendly to me.
Oh, this is...
I am concerned, actually, that this is my fear, is that I'm going to go in and they're just going to proselytize.
Okay, see, this is the thing. I want to break down the myth of comic book store guy. We all have seen comic book store guy on The Simpsons, and we all have these views in our heads of sort of what it is like when we go into a comic book store, and this is also true of music stores, that you're going to go in and the first thing you're going to feel is judged.
Jack Black and High Fidelity.
You don't have it? That is perverse. Don't tell anybody. You don't own f***ing Blonde on Blonde.
Top five side ones. Track ones. Janie Jones, Clash, from The Clash.
Hey.
Let's Get It On, Marvin Gaye from Let's Get It On.
Couldn't you be any more obvious than that, Rob? How about, I don't know, The Beatles? How about Beethoven? Track one, side one of the Fifth Symphony.
You guys, it's not...
No, we're not.
No, seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars, so you're shit on the people who know less than you.
No.
Which is everybody.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that that stereotype isn't a stereotype for a reason. I'm not saying that there aren't instances of snobby jerks who peer imperiously over the customers at these places. I'm sure there are. It has almost never been my experience as a consumer, particularly at music stores, but I was raised by comic book nerds. I've been to comic book stores. The people who staff those places, they're job is to interact with the public, and they're nerds.
Yeah. They in a good way.
In a good way. They're warm-hearted nerds.
They're enthusiasts.
Enthusiasts who want you to shop at their store and like what they like and share what they share. And, you know, yes, I have talked to people at comic book stores. I've talked to people at record stores who, under their breath, behind their, you know, the scenes, like, oh, you know, people came and asked for something. Here's a dumb thing that someone asked me for.
Right.
It happens. But for the most part, they're enthusiasts. They want to share. They want to help you.
They were very friendly to me. And I read a couple things that I picked up there for a little while. I don't know that I stuck with the stuff that I picked up that particular day. But there's no question that the things I picked up that particular day opened my mind to comics in general, which doesn't help them that much because what I wound up doing was reading Hawkeye on my tablet, which does not help them, but it helped me.
Well, they're in transition like everybody else is. Personally, I read trades that I buy at the comic book store at my local shop, but I have switched to reading monthly comics, I guess, floppies, we used to call them back in the
Jurassic.
We used to call them floppies.
Yeah. Comic books are floppies.
Back entirely on a tablet, just because I have a very tiny apartment.
Yeah.
It's very, very tiny.
And
I do not fetishize the object. I fetishize the story. I see them as periodicals, so I don't collect them. I accumulate them. So it's really good for me to be able to kind of have it appear on my tablet instantaneously. What we're losing, and we're losing it in bookstores, we're losing it in music stores, is that transaction at the checkout counter, which for as many times as it could be, you know, sneering condescension, those moments when I was buying music at a record store and I got the validation, I got the, oh, this is good. Right. Was just enough to make me want to go back to that store and keep trying. It's like a rat that only intermittently gets the pellet.
This is a thing that used to happen for me in the back room at the Tower Records here in Washington, D.C.
Where is this story? I know where the story is.
The furthest room in the Tower Records. You go in the store, through the pop stuff, through the new
bowels
releases.
Bowels of the classical music
area? It was actually up the stairs. So it wasn't really in the bowels. It was a great space. But it was sealed off from the rest of the store so that you could listen to your classical music in peace and quiet.
It was in the sinuses.
I was going to say, that's not why it was sealed off.
Shut up.
The sinuses.
But those guys had to earn their spots in the classical department. And you went in there, and if you picked up the Phillips recording of Jesse Norman singing the Strauss Four Last Songs, and the guy, you know, you checked it out, and the guy was like, you know, that one has a rosette in the guidebook.
Oh, boy.
The classical music guy at Exclusive Company on State Street in downtown Madison, that guy had like 40 years of experience in that spot.
Right?
It was a thing,
and those physical places don't exist anymore. Which is, you know, probably why on Friday of last week, when I was waxing rhapsodic about the Mahler Second Symphony and the finale thereof, everyone sitting around near me was just rolling their eyes like Linda Holmes just did behind the microphone.
Well, that's actually, that eye rolling is mostly boredom.
Yeah. I didn't roll my eyes at Mahler. I rolled my eyes because I knew what you were going to say.
All right. I'm going to temporarily stick up for the surly record store, bookstore, comic book store clerk because that person was me for almost a third of my life. I worked in an independent bookstore.
Video store clerks, too.
Mm-hmm. Video store clerks, absolutely. Yeah. You get worn down. You go into working at a place like that, a brick-and-mortar store like that, because you love whatever medium it is, and you perhaps, in many, many cases, especially with bookstores, want to feel like you want to belong to that medium
and
in some way.
In many, many cases, you are a practitioner in some way.
Exactly.
Half of those guys in the classical department were in paid choir jobs or whatever.
Absolutely. And something happens when art and commerce come bashing into each other like loggerheads, I guess. You start to get a little disillusioned. I happen to think now, looking back, it was a very useful kind of disillusion to have. Dispelling romantic notions is a very good thing for especially writers because we've got enough of them. But, you know, I happen to work in a bookstore around the time that The Bridges of Madison County
came
dear.
Out.
And, you know, I went into it thinking of it was going to be like 84 Charing Cross Road. You ever see that film? Where it's about a bookstore in England and Bancroft wants to get Samuel Pepys' diaries. And, you know, nobody ever asked me for Samuel Pepys' diaries. They asked me for The Bridges of Madison County, a demonstrably, egregiously, empirically bad book, line by line. And that kind of thing can just wear away at you.
My thing with bookstores, obviously we went through this initial stage where the kind of independent bookstore panic, I would say, not even recently, but like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
When it was, will borders kill?
Exactly. When it was, will borders kill independent bookstores? Borders, and at that time, you know, Borders, Barnes & Noble, you know, other mall stores, things like that. And this is sort of the argument that's adopted in You've Got Mail and things like that, is that you need physical independent bookstores because you need people to tell you what to buy.
Right.
And they are experts who can tell you what to buy. And I always felt like that is not an argument that I think is going to work on most people. However, I was just reading something in the Christian Science Monitor about the fact that some independent bookstores have kind of found an equilibrium. and are doing fine. And they were saying the reasons for that, first of all, the closure of some of the big ones like Borders and sure. ones like that are funneling what traffic remains in print books, print shopping, back to those places. But also that they've kind of found a way to exist as places that have events and things
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was going to be something.
And they've found a way to be a home for super, super involved people who want that to be the culture that they live in.
Yeah.
That, to me, is a better argument than an ordinary person walking down the street doesn't have the taste required to buy a book. That that I always felt was like, I mean, the lady who goes into the store and You've Got Mail and sort of says, you know, doesn't really remember the name of the author. And the thing you're supposed to be so upset about is that the clerk, who actually is played by Chris Messina, by the way, if you, he's on The Mindy Project and some other stuff. He's about 12 in this movie, doesn't know anything. Now, in the age of the internet, if that's your whole argument, you're going to lose your whole argument.
Right. Right.
So I think they've done better by remaking themselves as physical centers for enthusiasts. And that's the part that I worry about, is the loss
yep.
of physical centers for enthusiasts to gather.
And this was a point I really, really wanted to make, which was, not only do I miss, you know, when I don't go to record stores as much, the conversations with the clerks and just kind of that area in which people are in person talking about music, I miss CD release parties.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I miss in stores.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
to me, that's one thing that was really important for us when we were starting the Tiny Desk concerts.
Explain what you mean by an in-store. Not yeah. everybody knows what
sure.
that term is.
I wish everybody knew, because I wish everybody has been to a million of them. It's where bands, when they come through town, or it's singer-songwriters when they come through town, would perform a short, you know, 4 or 5 song concert at a record store at which they're trying to sell their record.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get these wonderful sort of like radio session length performances of, in many cases, wonderful bands that are there. And again, it's converting the retail space into a venue, into mm-hmm. a cultural center. And it's one area, it's an area that I think the Tiny Desk concerts, you know, I hope are filling a
right.
little bit of that vacuum
sure.
of these wonderful performances. And I've had wonderful experiences of seeing bands perform these short sets and then do autograph signings. And obviously, it's like book readings at a bookstore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or book readings, for instance, at that other community-based center for enthusiasts, the library.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, sure.
Right, sure.
I'll say this for those entitled millennials. When it comes to instant gratification, they're right. It's good.
Right.
It's a very good thing. Just before I got on a plane, I'd forgotten to buy a book of short stories. I pressed a button
right.
in the airport waiting area, and it
right.
was on there, and it was ready for me. But you do feel, and we've discussed this before, you do start to feel like it's turning everybody into Veruca Salt. I want it now.
Right.
You do start to feel like you're a king saying, summon my fool that he may regale me with tales of battle and disaffected 20-somethings from Park Slope who want to get into publishing and meet cute at a co-op. Also, if there could be a sassy gay neighbor. I'm just spitballing. You know, that's, you do feel like you are commanding
yeah.
things. And,
yeah.
and there's no barrier. There's no effort.
Did you just say effort?
I did say effort.
The gathering place business, I think, is the thing that troubles me a little bit. Because when I think about that, you know, they always use the expression third space with regard to places like Starbucks. Right?
Mm-hmm.
In addition
mm-hmm.
to your home, you've got your home, your work, and then this
yeah,
third space where you live part of your life. And I think for a lot of people, that used to be a record store, a bookstore,
yeah.
a video store. And now it's more likely to be a Starbucks, in part because it's a place where you can get free internet.
Right.
So it's mm-hmm. it's just a place to hop on what has taken the place of a lot of those locations, which is online communities of enthusiasts,
mm-hmm.
which they gain a great deal in accessibility, but they lose something in numerosity to me. You might belong, as a music fan, you might belong to 20 different communities where people comment about music. Whereas if you had one record store, there's a good chance that was your home base.
Yeah.
And it had a special place in your heart because it was the one, the bookstore that you went to all the time, the bookstore that you loved, the video store where you rented movies when you were a teenager. And I worry that those online places, although they can be great communities of enthusiasts, that they're a little bit more, they come in and out of your life a little more easily.
Mm-hmm. I'm a very sentimental person about places,
sure,
in part because of the extra senses that they affect. Mm-hmm. You know, an online community, and I'm a member of online communities, and creating an online community is part of my job, but I definitely love the smell of a record store or the feel of, you know, I've never been a Starbucks guy, in part because I don't drink coffee, but, you know, little warm, and this makes me sound like a total goob, but you know,
for the first time ever,
but you know, like, well, it sounds like I'm being like, well, I don't like Starbucks, but I like independent.
No, I know
like,
what you're talking about.
You know, warm kind of person-owned places that have an idiosyncratic.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I watched the last episode of Game of Thrones. I watched it on my iPad at a coffee shop, an independently owned coffee shop, where the Persian owner roasts the beans been roasting the beans, and I've been going there since 1993.
Yeah. Well, I just went back to my hometown of Madison, Wisconsin, and went to Indie Coffee, and it's owned by friends of mine, but I just felt embraced the surroundings.
Absolutely.
And there's great music, and there are posters, and there, you know, that feel of, yes, it has internet where, you know, I can download something on my, you know, whatever, but it's a perfect example of a third space that kind of, these somewhat more synthetic, ticky-tack, they all look the same places,
I think that part of what you're putting your finger on, and the difference between Starbucks and an independent place, is not that nobody that works at Starbucks has a soul, or Starbucks doesn't have a soul, or you can't have a good conversation at a Starbucks. Those things are all silly. What they do have is, like you said, they're idiosyncratic, independent places. And so they have, again, that sense that there's only that one place, whereas Starbucks is almost more like an online community where there's as many of them as you care to go to. You can walk around Manhattan and just go from Starbucks to Starbucks all day. I'm not saying I might have done it recently. You can really hop from one to another because they're so close and there are so many of them. So, I mean, to me, one of the places that I am like that about, and it's a little off the topic of strict culture, is the farmer's market in my town, which I like to go to on Sundays. And because it has those unique qualities where over here is the guy that you get the eggs from, and if you don't get there before they open, there's not going to be eggs when you get there because he sells out of eggs in the first 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then the people over here that have the bread, and I don't like that bread place because it's too, they have the real tough, hard breads I like over here where they have the softer, yeastier ones.
The feel of...
And this particular produce stand at Eastern Market on Capitol Hill in D.C. is the one where the Calamaris family has run it forever, and the lady who runs the stand on Saturday mornings always puts a little extra piece of fruit in your bag.
I love farmer's markets in theory.
Yeah.
Well, that's but you get, what I'm saying is you get good at a place.
Yeah.
And I think that record stores and bookstores and video stores are sometimes like that too. You get good at that place.
You figure out which member of the staff, when they recommend something, you pay special note.
Right. And it's not that that can't happen online, but I do a little bit worry about physical spaces not continuing to have the primacy that they
And if most retail purchases are made mail order, then where are the businesses?
Well,
you know, you start to actually have a drain on local economies that's a massive problem.
Right. And that's a whole economics problem that I completely acknowledge, but that I feel separately about. Mm-hmm. Separately from the issue of where are you purchasing your stuff.
Right.
There used to be this alignment between where you purchased your stuff as the, you know, you purchased your stuff at your cultural center, essentially. And what that meant was when Glenn was talking about record store clerks and when you guys were talking about record store clerks and bookstore people as experts, as people who would know things, the advantage to that was they knew things, they were right there, and they could put the thing in your hand and you could buy it. Now, I think the record store clerk of yesterday is the blogger of today, and they can still direct you to the link and go and whatever, you can go buy it, but you don't see them in person. It's not a one-on-one interaction with you.
Right. And you're not necessarily putting food on their table.
Right. But you're not, they're not as likely to know you personally and you come in. I mean, there's some of that, but it's not quite the same.
Right.
And I feel like those same people who used to be your video, you know, your kid who became a video store clerk now would start his own movie blog. Mm. And it's just a little different.
The good news is it's more important to be able to write well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Well, also the idea of people who bought this also bought this. That's an algorithm I don't particularly care about because that's not about personality. That's not about taste. That's not about I like this about it. That's why I bought this too.
Yeah.
That's simple buying habits. That has nothing to do with any kind of engagement with the material itself.
And it will also never, those algorithms will never help you discover anything really new, because I find on Amazon, because I buy a lot of romance novels as ebooks, it's now the only thing they ever recommend to me is like a bunch more of them.
That's my
and
point.
So if I go on there and I'm like, well, I've bought a bunch of these and I do know all these writers and I know that some of them have 25 more books. What I would really like to do is get on there and have them be like, what we recommend for you is that you read something else. Recommended for you, read something else. Yeah. But that's never going to happen because that's not how they do their algorithms.
So you need a sneering snob.
Yep, exactly.
To cluck his tongue at you.
I volunteer.
Sometimes I need a snob. Sometimes I need somebody to be like, hey, recommended for you, change of pace. But anyway. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us how you feel about your local brick and mortar shop, your local cultural institution, and what your buying habits look like when you don't have that person to be a snob in your face.
To join our virtual online community.
Right. Join our virtual online.
Tell us that we're being absurdly sentimental.
We're not physically there.
No, of course. Okay, so the other thing we were going to talk about this week, I had mentioned to the fellas, as I like to call them, that there were a couple of TV premieres coming up that had to do with science on television, one of which is the 10th anniversary of MythBusters. They're about to start another season with their 10th anniversary. And another is a show on the Discovery Channel called The Big Brain Theory, not The Big Bang Theory, not to be confused, or possibly to be confused, but The Big Brain Theory, which is a competition show. It's almost like Chopped. And it's hosted by Cal Penn, and they put these bunch of scientists through these little scientific challenges. Like in the first one, they rig up two pickup trucks with explosives, and then they run them into each other, and they blow up.
I'm in.
And they say, what you have to do is rig up the explosives so they won't blow up. So you get two teams. One is in charge of one pickup truck. The other is in charge of the other pickup truck. And then they're going to smash them into each other. And the idea is to design something that will keep your explosives on your side from blowing up. The point being, it's scientific challenges. So this is kind of like a little competition show as opposed to MythBusters, which is more of a, like a documentary show.
What it actually is random testosterone venting disguised as
It depends. I mean, testosterone venting, are you equating testosterone with explosions?
Yes.
Because explosions needn't be testosterone laden.
Okay, it was a joke. Let's not let's not deconstruct it too far.
Well, I think both of these, I will say both of these shows, from what I've seen, I mean, MythBusters, as Stephen knows, always involves a certain amount of exploding, and Big Brain Theory does too. But anyway, so what we wanted to talk about was these are both science shows. Science shows are very big. There are a lot of different science shows, both scripted and unscripted. And so we thought we would talk a little bit about science. Glenn, you look like you have thoughts about science.
Well, I do, because I believe I am qualified to speak on this topic, as my undergraduate degree is in marine biology, and my day job is actually at a research organization, and my day job is basically to translate science to a lay audience. And one of the things that struck me about...
You said lay audience.
I did say lay audience. Titter, titter, titter. Science has this rep in a lot of popular culture as, you know, the practice of cold, dogmatic, entirely cerebral people. I have found that not to be the case. Science is a way of approaching the world. It's a way of trying to imagine the world, of testing the world, but it's not what it's not solely about having a hypothesis and testing it.
Right.
It's about adjusting that hypothesis to meet what happens. And I have conflated science with the popular presentation of science once before in my life. When I went to marine biology school, the first day they gather you in the auditorium and the guy gets up there and says, now, how many of you are here because you saw a lot of Jacques Cousteau specials and you want to talk to dolphins? And everybody in the room is like, well, no, no, we want the science. We want test tubes, and if there can be some agar involved in some way, that's what we want. But every one of us was there because we saw a lot of Jacques Cousteau specials and wanted to talk to every single one. Uh-huh. And then
you were inspired by Aquaman.
Yeah, well, that helped, too. I'm not going to say it didn't help. But he got up there and he said, Jacques Cousteau is a filmmaker, like with like venom in his voice.
Yeah.
And you could see the shoulders slump around you as that epiphany, that little
weight
just dropped.
Do we have to hate Jacques Cousteau?
I know, right? So the closest, I think, that any show has ever gotten to that way of saying this is a way of investigating the world is Mythbusters, because mm-hmm. it's about testing, exploring, and then adjusting the hypothesis.
Yeah.
Now, do they not control for every variable in a way that kind of leaves me nuts? Do they sometimes make conclusions based on an experiment that really they didn't take X, Y, and Z into account in a way that kind of gives me a pain behind my eye? Yes.
But they acknowledge it. And what I like about how they treat things like controlling for factors is they talk about the fact that you have to do that. They
right.
might not yeah. control for everything, and they might not think of everything that you should control for. But they talk about the fact that if you're going to test one thing, you have to try. They illustrate that all the time, that mm-hmm. you have to, for example, when Grant is building robots to do some repetitive motion like swinging a sword,
yeah.
that you would never swing a sword with your arm to test something because it won't be the same every time.
Exactly.
So you do build in that understanding of the fact that you have to try to make it the same way every time. And I think that's maybe what's more important than whether they control for every
Absolutely.
Individual thing. Every time.
And you see a lot of them failing and
mm-hmm.
redoing and,
yes.
oh my God, you know, we built this thing and we didn't take X into account and now we have to you know.
I actually take great comfort in the fact that they will disclose that they're not always controlling for everything, because I'm still disturbed about the outcome of the how do the poop germs get on your toothbrush thing.
Okay.
But the outcome of that one was great, because the outcome of that one was like, yeah, there's some, but there's some everywhere.
Yeah. So, okay.
Exactly. It's like there'd be poop germs on it if you kept it in the kitchen. So congratulations, there's poop germs on
it. And ultimately, it's a television show. It's not mm-hmm. a presentation at a symposium. So even though it would get laughed out of the Academy, they called me mad at the Academy. You know, it's a TV show, and it's a very entertaining one.
Yeah.
And it says good things about science. It says
does.
What science is. It's not about people in lab coats staring into test tubes saying, I need to know more. There are some things man was not meant to know.
Right.
That kind of thing. That's not what it's about.
I actually think that there is a kind of pop culture trope about the mad scientist that gets at something intrinsic to the scientific disposition that you have not yet enumerated, which is that.
Oh, God. Do you really talk like this?
I do. What? Which is that there is a bit of mad scientist, because everybody who designs an experiment has some sort of weird little brainstorm in the back of their head that mm-hmm. says, here's what we know about the world. What if there's this other thing out there? Let me design an experiment that pushes the boundary in that direction.
Right.
Right?
Well, that's why I always object to this idea of there's imagination and there's science. And
right.
science is the
right.
absence
oh,
of
absolutely.
Imagination.
No, absolutely.
Or this notion that, exactly what we were saying before, there are some things man was not meant to know.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there's some doors we were not meant to open. Okay, mm-hmm. well, if we can't open it, it's not a door. It's a wall. Okay?
It has a hinge.
It's got a hinge. It's got a knob. It's a door. But yeah, that's exactly it. Because, and if you think about it, all those approaches that say, he's gone beyond the realms of what man can know, which is a very old concept.
Sure.
It goes back to the Tower of Babel. It goes back, and it's a lot of, it's very Victorian, Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll.
The Garden of Eden.
The Garden of Instinct.
Yeah,
exactly. That is a very anti-science
yeah.
concept. It's an anti-intellectual concept. It's an anti-imagination concept, and it's very moralistic.
Well, and I want to talk about science shows a little bit through the lens of how they affect, in many cases, the kids
mm-hmm.
that watch them. And one thing that I absolutely love about the fact that one of my kids, more than others, is obsessed with Mythbusters and will occasionally decide to go back and rewatch them all in order
mm-hmm.
is that it is creating less credulous viewers.
Good.
That they are creating a young, skeptical society
mm-hmm.
and people who don't simply believe things because they're told them.
Yeah.
And I think that's an incredibly valuable skill. I remember when I was in fourth grade, there was a program in my school called Propaganda. And I don't remember the origins of it, but it was basically teaching kids how to lie with statistics. There's actually a great book called How to Lie yeah. with Statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically like, here is how advertising can lie to you.
Right.
And you don't necessarily want your kids to be bitter curmudgeons about everything. You don't want them to turn into Glenn.
Well, not all of my kids.
Yeah.
But,
you have
but
one.
The fact that kids are taught to challenge received wisdom is going to create more interesting adults. And that's what you
yeah,
want.
Exactly.
I think that's right. You know, when I went back to think about science and scientists in pop culture, I was thinking about, as Trey was mentioning, you have your mad scientists in the kind of crazy way. And in the way Glenn was talking about, where it's this very hazardous opening the door to that which should not be known. Dr. Frankenstein and Jekyll and Hyde and Pet Sematary.
Sure.
Things like that.
Science, okay. Not really science, but okay.
It's not, but it's the same, you know, what I'm talking about. It's the, you're right, it's not science. But what I'm saying is there are a lot of scientists that give you the equivalent of Pet Sematary.
Sure. No, that's exactly right.
Messing with the natural world, mm-hmm. with the natural order of things.
Right.
The same way that that does in a non-scientific way. This is in a scientific way. And then you have your crazy but awesome, like Doc Brown in
Back to the Future scientists.
And those kind of guys are the guys who everybody goes to. The hero will often go visit that scientist to help with some crazy plan. I don't know whether this happens in Superman comics, but on Lois and Clark, they did this all the time. There was like the scientist that they could go to.
Professor Hamilton.
To try to get information about what would happen to Clark if they did this and this and this. So you have those scientists who are your allies. And then you have sort of the bumbling scientists who accidentally stumble upon some horrible, you know, mean well, the science out of control, the Jurassic Park
Apes.
and that sort of
Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
This is basically
Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Steve.
This guy or this woman is basically the instigating persona and incident for every episode of the TV show Eureka.
Right. I'm sure. But you also have, and some of my favorites are the adventure scientists. Like, effectively, MacGyver is a scientist in a way because he's a tinkerer. And so you also have the adventure scientists are like in Alien or Avatar or Quantum Leap.
Or Doctor Who.
Well, I was just going to say, every episode somebody gets mad at us because we did not mention Doctor Who. So, Doctor Who. And those guys, the adventure scientists, are some of the ones that I think are the most interesting and the most fun because they're out there encountering scientific principles in the actual world. And even though they always said that MacGyver, like anytime he built an explosive, there was some ingredient missing so that you couldn't just go make it in your kitchen. He's sort of the scripted Mythbusters guy because he was trying things. Mm. And they actually did an episode of Mythbusters one time when they did a bunch of MacGyver experiments.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of them did not work, including his hang glider, which they pointed out would not work at all.
In the opening credits.
Yeah. They just, his hang glider, it turns out, was a complete crock. But I guess I would ask the other question, what is the role of science fiction in that science fiction is trying to fit, in my experience, sometimes there's some scientific truth to it, but sometimes they're trying to fit the scientific rubric but use unreal facts, like unreal science.
Well, there's a saying that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And boy, if that weren't true, Star Trek would not exist.
Yeah.
There's an entire plot points are couched in what has been called technobabble, which is just a way of kind of waving your hand and saying, wizard did it.
Right. Or,
you know,
except science did it.
A wizard with a phaser did it.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying to do is tell stories. And, of course, what science fiction does is it uses metaphor to explore things about the human condition. Now, there's also something called hard science fiction, which Star Trek is very resolutely not. Hard science fiction concentrates on scientific accuracy to the extent that, for me, we've said this before, it's called science fiction, not science boring. So you can spend all your time trying to prove to me how accurate something is. But for me, what's more important is plausibility, not accuracy. Mm-hmm. I need to take me on this ride with you and help me get there. But yeah, I mean, a lot of science fiction just basically treats the science as magic and tries to tell human stories. Doctor Who famously, when push comes to shove, is reduced to saying, well, it's sort of like a wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey substance. And we kind of say, okay, we get it. We don't need to follow this because ultimately what's important is
invisible turkey lizard.
Exactly.
That's right.
What's important is establish the rules and then stop talking about them.
Whereas,
just get on with the story.
Whereas I am exactly the kind of nerd who wants to go to io9.com and read about why Skynet might, in fact, be expected to emerge from simple physics, which is the actual title of an actual blog post at io9 right now.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, the entire web is pretty much devoted to taking a story and individual Star Trek episodes and saying, I don't think so.
Believe this is a magic xylophone?
Exactly. Yeah. It's that impulse, which is very strong. And that kind of, it's, you know, there's a book called The Physics of Superheroes, which it could have been a leaflet. It could have said, this can't happen. And it's like, thanks, Professor Buzzkill, because it's not, you know, yeah. it doesn't matter if it could happen or not. No.
Yeah.
I did want to throw out a recommendation. It's kind of getting back a little bit to the quasi-educational, we brought together kids and had them do science. If you haven't seen, or if your kids haven't seen, if you like watching things blow up, if you haven't seen Destroy, Build, Destroy, I'm a big fan of Destroy, Build, Destroy. It is hosted by none other than Andrew W.K., who is the perfect person to preside over kids blowing things up. We also should mention Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
I don't think we should let this episode go by.
Absolutely.
Without
Bill Nye the Science Guy, Beekman's World.
3-2-1 Contact.
3-2-1 Contact.
People who actually sit down and make science entertaining for kids.
There have been a ton of science shows.
Newton's Apple.
There have been a ton of people making science shows. There is also an entirely different branch of this conversation that's really about cultural portrayal of nerds, and we did that. We have sort of steered around that because we did have a whole episode, which you can go back and find, which is about nerd culture and portrayal of geeks, and we did the whole Big Bang Theory conversation at that time.
Yeah. I also quickly want to bring up the way that certain depictions of science can affect the way we view things like crime and the sort of the CSI effect of... Because we have used science to create, you know, ironclad evidence of X in ways that are more black and white than they should be.
And, and those shows fictionalize that particular kind of science in a way that is so far from reality.
I think it really is skewing the public understanding of it. Well, there's some dispute over whether juries really are like that, whether they really now will not listen to your evidence unless you have DNA and stuff like that. But I don't think there's any question that things like DNA and forensic evidence and things like that have certainly come much more into the public understanding. And I think there is a lack of understanding of how difficult it is to understand what happened in many situations.
Yeah.
And I think anytime you hear about a crime or whatever, people expect that there's eventually going to be a perfect recreation, which will show you exactly what happened, just like there is on CSI or Law and Order.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And we all should spend some time on the kind of science show, which are actually pseudoscience shows, which have the trappings of science, but are completely freaking bogus. We've talked about Ghost Hunters
before.
Where people walk around with oscilloscopes and Texas Instruments calculators and say, oh, it's kind of cold over here, and pretend to be collecting evidence that they never do anything with. There's also those shows like Chariot of the Gods or In Search Of, or modern equivalents, which, you know, do nothing but say, could ancient astronauts have visited Peru? No, sorry, guys.
The answer, no.
End of show. Right. That stuff is really galling.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up entirely, I want to return to something that's kind of akin to what Stephen was talking about with the kids' science shows, the Bill Nyes and the Destroy, Build, Destroys. There is a new thing called the Stranger Than Fiction podcast. It lives at the Slate Future Tense blog. And it's kind of what Stephen was describing, except it's for adults practicing science. It's a series of interviews with great science fiction writers about how you inspire people who do science to take that next stretch, to reach for that next big invention. The idea is kind of that there have been instances in the past where visionary writers have inspired real technological leaps, and that the best of these writers can not just imagine a gigantic innovation, but can, to use a quote from this particular project, can supply a coherent picture of that innovation being integrated into a society, into an economy, and into people's lives. The podcast is hosted by Tim Wu, who's this big forward thinker, one of the early proponents of net neutrality. And the first interviewee is Neal Stephenson, the author of Cryptonomicon and Snow Crash and books like that, and a real futurist.
Okay. So you are recommending the
podcast. I am recommending that, yes.
Excellent. Well, we hope that all of you will come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and tell us about your favorite pop culture scientists and science shows, and the ones, of course, that your kids like, because, you know, that's a big part of it. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
All right, one thing no one will care about and one thing that some people will really like, but give me just the briefest of indulgences of the fact that over the weekend I spent about 20 hours watching the NFL draft. Now, I understand it's basically watching teams pick lottery numbers, and I get that it's only entertaining to a few hardcore diehards. But there was a change in the way they did it. And for the eight people who care about the NFL draft, I just want to talk about how wonderful it is that they stopped doing the thing that was ruining the NFL draft for me. Namely, the way that the hosts would spoil the picks. Basically, you know, each team is picking a player. And then, you know, they get up on at a podium and they say, you know, with the 26th pick of the first round, the Green Bay Packers select Dayton Jones, whatever. Before, you would have the host would be like, I wonder where Green Bay is going to go next, perhaps on the defensive line, where they would try to sound smart, even though they had been spoiled on the picks 20 seconds in advance.
Right.
And so you have the effect of it's as if you were watching the Oscars. Okay. And when they announce, like, Best Actress, and Sandra Bullock is about to win the Oscar, it would be like the announcer saying, perhaps Oscar has a blind spot for our next winner.
Good.
It's infuriating if you actually care and want to be surprised and view this thing as entertainment. ESPN stopped doing it. The NFL Network stopped doing it. They took a thing that I enjoyed and made it better, and that's making me happy. Okay. Now for an actual recommendation that people will like. Record Store Day was recently. We've got Free Comic Book Day coming up. We just had Record Store Day. Record Store Day includes a whole bunch of exclusive to Record Store Day releases that people can buy, and some of them are wonderful. And I really wanted to call attention to a 7-inch single that you can buy, and you can. It's also available as a download when you buy the 7-inch single, of Sharon Van Etten and Shearwater getting together and performing Tom Petty and Stevie Nicks' Stop Dragging My Heart Around. And it is absolutely wonderful. Jess, hit us with a moment of that. I love the way that it finds them meeting at the midpoint between their own voices and the voices that they are covering.
Yeah,
it's just wonderful. The B-side is gorgeous. It's lovely. Shearwater and Sharon Van Etten doing Stop Dragging My Heart Around. It was available at Record Store Day, but you can still find the single floating around.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
It's kind of bittersweet, but I'll get to something that's making me happy. Today, Monday, it was announced that the comics news site Comics Alliance was shuttering. Its owner, AOL, has decided to go with a different strategy. The traffic on the site was higher than it's ever been, but the AOL decided to go a different way. And let's give them some credit, because if you think about, you know, the future of the web... AOL. It's right up there with Alta Vista and GeoCities. People who are really leading the way. It was a dumb decision because there were some really great writers on that site. It was a site that engaged questions of race, sexuality, gender in mainstream comics in a way that that few others did, and consistently with some really smart, funny writing. So it will be greatly missed, but those writers are going to go on to bigger and better things. I do want to point out one specific piece written by Chris Sims, which is a takedown of a comic called Injustice. Now, Injustice is a video game that I just got this weekend, which is about, you know, where you can fight, have your heroes fight each other. What's going to be better than that? At one point, if you hit the right buttons, Aquaman summons a tidal wave, and in that tidal wave, a big shark comes and takes a big bite out of your opponent. It's pretty awesome. Empirically, that's just science. But the premise of this thing is that Superman has gone rogue. Now, this is not the first fascist Superman story we've ever heard, but this is perhaps the dumbest. Because to get Superman to go rogue, the storyline behind this, and I'm not spoiling anything because this is the premise of the game, the Joker ties a nuclear detonator to the heartbeat of Lois Lane. If Lois Lane's heartbeat stops, the town of Metropolis will be destroyed. He then drugs Superman, convinces him that Lois Lane is actually his nemesis, Doomsday. So Superman takes Lois Lane into outer orbit, where she dies. I think he also beats her up while doing it, which causes Metropolis to blow up. And then we find out that she was pregnant with his son. It's like, okay, I did not sign on for any of this.
It's a baby with a cape.
That's right. Can I just throw a batarang at Bane? Can I just do that?
Yeah.
That's A. B is pick one.
You lost me at the Joker, because did those worlds collide at the beginning and you didn't mention
it? That's the whole point of the thing, is that they all keep colliding in really dumb ways. This is a very dumb idea and a very stupid, over-the-top approach. And there's a comic about it. And so Chris Sims, one of the site's very funny writers, just basically launches into this comic in a way that's very funny and very heartening. And we'll link to that, because even though it's a little bit inside baseball, it's still just great writing and you'll enjoy it. So there'll be a link on the website.
AOL had quite a week, didn't they? They also closed all their music.
They did.
Properties.
They did.
Spinner
and
which are
Anyway,
happy.
Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Okay, well, among other things, there is actually an article called "How Skynet Might Emerge from Simple Physics," which depends for its argument on papers published by Harvard researchers, and they depend on their arguments for Busso's causal entropic principle and a thing called cognitive niche theory, which are things that exist.
Okay.
And I promise you, this article might very well make you wet your pants, because it posits that rather than machines becoming sentient and then deciding to take over the world, it argues that the desire to control the outcome of all possible futures is necessary to the eventual sentience of machines. Flips that equation that we all know from science fiction across many, many decades, and turns it on its head and argues that we are all essentially doomed.
There are some pretty sophisticated new washing machines.
Also, a gift that I was given recently. It's a journal, which is always a thoughtful gift. But this came from someone who clearly knows either me or Glenn Weldon very well. It is called In My Humble Opinion, a journal to vent about why people are like that and why all the stupid things they do are so obvious to me. And it comes with an introductory essay about the value of journaling, which posits that, in line with our conversation about science, anger is a form of energy and thus cannot be destroyed, only converted. And it recommends that we do this by journaling with vitriol about the people
who
have...
Is that a knock-knock product?
It is a knock-knock product.
It looks like a knock-knock product.
It is a knock-knock product. Each day comes with a handy quote to inspire you. Today's is by Albert Einstein, and it says, "Only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the former."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Knock-knock, which you can find at knockknockstuff.com, which I know because I overspend there frequently, is also where I get my my high-five notepads and my some of my other wonderful little notepads that I enjoy using around work.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Trey.
In my humble opinion.
In your humble opinion. Excellent choice. I am going to keep it very short this week. I did mention this on Twitter the other day, but the thing making me happy this week at our new building, the part of the building that I am located in looks down upon the newsroom with railings around it. And the other day, I watched Scott Simon and Nina Totenberg sing "Don't Cry For Me, Argentina" over the balcony,
from the balcony
of our new building. They really did. This really happened.
Do I not believe you?
And verse?
No. They just,
probably
they
just the chorus.
Just a little bit of it, yeah. He was trying to, you know, remember more of it, and then I think, you know, she was over it. No, I'm just kidding. It was wonderful. It was wonderful, and I was almost the only person sort of paying enough attention to enjoy it.
I find that hard to believe.
No, I was. Because the sound is muffled, you know.
Okay.
And I was really the only person sort of tuned into this and watching, and I was cheering for them, and it was pretty great. Not necessarily the singing, but... But I kid Scott Simon and Nina Dobrev. Both very nice people. And it just was funny. It was just one of those things that comes out of nowhere, and you smile, and it makes your day. So that is what made me happy this week, along with, you know, presumably other things, but none of them come to mind right now. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E, and Graham like the Graham in Graham Cracker. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.